Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckadelics, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. That stands for what the fuck. How's everybody doing? We're coming in at, I don't know how many episodes I've done, 800 and something, and I'm here. I'm here in my garage, sitting amongst the piles, gathering dust. It's weird when a place, when you sit down and you realize, like, I've been working in this place for almost a decade, right here in this garage. I've got some time, and I've moved some shit around on the deck, and I'm going to start taking shit out of here and looking at it. I'm going to take everything out, give it a good once over, and say, garbage or not garbage, it's time. Blues legends, Taj Mahal and Keb Mo on the show today. Blues legends who did not bring their guitars. But Taj Mahal picks up my old weird guitar, the old K guitar, and plays something for like 30 seconds, and I wanted it to continue for an hour. I have no control over these things. All right. There was a lot of mics. I didn't know how to, you know, two people in here. Wasn't sure how I was going to do the music recording. Then they didn't have guitars. All right. Maybe I could ask them to play more, but I didn't. All right. But anyways, they're on the show. All right. So you know that. Why can't I just have fun? There are people that know how to look. I know the world is on fire. We don't know what's going to happen from day to day, but we know it's not good. And that's an undeniable. That is without question. So that's a backdrop to trying to have fun in life. I don't know if I've ever been capable of it. I've talked to you guys about this before. Some people seem to have fun. Maybe they have lower expectations. I don't know what it is. I can have an okay time. You know, like for me, if it doesn't involve eating or having an orgasm, there's a big drop off. You know, those are fun. And then everything else is like, yeah, it was all right. Yeah, I went on a hike today. It was okay. I didn't eat cake or cum, but it was nice. It was nice. You know, I didn't think it was the right environment for those things. You know, some things you can't do at the same time. But maybe I'm being a coward. Maybe I'm being a pussy. Maybe next time I take a hike up Runyon Canyon, I should just figure out a way to have a nice big slab of chocolate cake while I'm jerking off, walking up the hill. Yeah, make it interesting for the yoga ladies and their dumb dogs. Stay away from that, man. That's not your cake. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I jammed with some people. That happened. Some of my rock star dreams, some of my jamming, my rock jam dreams are happening. I jammed and it was good. I jammed with professional musicians, professional drummer, Mark Stepro, professional bass player, Tyler Chester, and professional guitar player, Adam Levy. And we did the thing. You know, I never know what to do with jams. I don't think that, you know, I guess it's just a confidence thing because I don't play with people. I got to get over that because I just bought a Paul Kossoff record for all. I know a lot of people are like, no shit, Paul Kossoff. Some of you are like, Paul who? What? Paul Kossoff. I just was at a record store and they had a solo album. I forget which one it is. He's got a couple, but he's the guitar player from Free, Paul Rogers' band, before Bad Company. Yeah, that's right. Paul Kossoff. Died of a heroin overdose, I believe, at a young age. Had a nice tone, but I bought a record. And there's an entire side that's one instrumental song, 16 minutes. Just that guy doing his thing with some band. Now, he's a good guitar player. But like, you know, I'm not comparing myself to him, but he didn't seem to be like, this is going on too long. And I get that immediately. I just gotta like lean into it, man. I gotta lose myself in it. I gotta lose myself in more shit. But anyway, so we go do this jam, and I'm trying to put together a song list. I had that in the back of my head, but I didn't really know what these guys wanted to do, whether they wanted to just, you know, indulge me. Like, hey, let's make the podcast guy happy for a minute. Let's let him live his little fantasy. So you get in and then, you know, you do a blues jam and you kind of figure out who everybody is and what they're capable of. And obviously I'm the low man on the totem pole, but I can hold my own all right. But then it's sort of like, did you bring any songs you want to work on? Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I have two I'd like to work on today. If we could, I'd like to work on Guilty by Randy Newman. And I would like to work on Jumping at Shadows by Peter Green. I think that one's a little trickier because I got to figure out how to sing that. But we did work on for an hour or so and arrange a version of Randy Newman's Guilty, which is one of my favorite songs in the world. And they just by chance knew, because they play with somebody else, Broke Down Palace by the Grateful Dead, which I've played and sung before. So we did a version of that. And then we did sort of an off-the-cuff version with none of them knowing the song of I Walk With Jesus by Spaceman 3. And we also sort of dicked around with Mystery Train, though I play everything a lot dirtier than these guys. These guys are tasteful players that know the space, know how to let things breathe, know how to turn it down, know how to, like, you know, change up the tone. And I'm just like, but then I'm sort of like, oh, look at it. I got this nice guitar and this amp. I can roll. I can switch the volume up. I can make choices. I'm not sure what I want out of it all. I mean, I'm very nervous singing, and I got to get my voice in shape. I got to do a little more of that. I think I can do it. I'm not looking to transition, folks. Not into a woman, but into a musician. I'm not looking to do that. I'm not looking to put out a record. But I might do a show where I have a little combo, and I do a few songs, a little comedy, have some other friends do some songs. Just to mark that off the bucket list. Play with other people, perform out, but not as a band. Just do a few songs in context and then maybe once sit in with Conan O'Brien's band. All right, is that asking too much? Are those doable dreams? I'm going to be on Conan tonight, by the way. All right, I don't know how it went yet because I haven't done it yet. All right, because I'm doing this early. I'm taping this earlier. If everything goes as planned and nothing horrible happens, I will be on Conan tonight. That's Thursday. Okay, you got it? So Taj Mahal, Keb Mo, veterans. I would say Taj is an elder statesman of the blues. He's been out there doing records and touring for years. Keb Mo as well, but Taj is older. And I've known about Taj a long time, and I've known about Keb Mo for a while, but I wasn't completely familiar with all their stuff until I knew they were coming on the show. And you know, I like blues, and these guys are the real deal. Couldn't pass on the opportunity to talk to Taj and Keb, who are touring right now, learn a few things about the blues, pick their brains a little bit, and have Taj Mahal pick up a guitar in here and play for about 30 seconds. It was great. It was a great 30 seconds. It's very specific. I was happy to have them. Their collaborative album, Taj Mo, is available now wherever you get music. They'll be back on tour in the U.S. starting next month. Go to tajmo.com for details. That's tajmo.com. Dig it. So this is me talking to the blues masters, Taj Mahal and Keb Mo. Pull that mic in, Taj. Pull it in. Wait, we'll get right up on you. Oh, there you are.
You want the DJ sound here?
Yeah, why not?
Yes,
a showdown on here on the late night show.
Yeah, yeah, yes. the late night show right here.
We got Keb Mo coming up with.
This is it.
You remember those guys?
No, Glenn Day. Serious, man. The boom, boom, Flanagan. And Murray the K.
You remember Murray the K?
Yeah, man. Come on.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, all of that, man. Yeah, been a long time. How about that?
What's the age difference between you guys?
What?
9 and a half.
Yeah.
Somewhere 9 and a half.
So on some level, when you were a kid, he was already going.
He was going.
Yeah. So you there was probably a point where you're like, I know who Taj Mahal is. I got that first record.
Taj Mahal. He came out and
68?
I saw Taj Mahal at school.
You did?
Yeah.
At 69.
In 69? Yeah. When you were in school?
Yeah.
He was in high
Where
school.
At?
Compton High School.
Out here?
Yeah.
Yep.
And were you playing already?
Yeah, I was already playing.
What were you playing?
I was playing steel drums, guitar, and French horn.
Steel drums. How do you choose that for the instrument of choice?
Oh,
well, I moved on the right block in Compton.
Right. Right. And the same thing essentially happened to me with guitar.
Yeah, what happened? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, we lived around the town in probably like three or four different apartment houses.
Yeah.
And my father got tired of it. Family was getting bigger.
Where was this?
In Massachusetts, Springfield, Massachusetts. And then tragedy, but we moved away from that area to another place to some people who lived next door to us and who my parents knew. And then 1 year, all of this happened. My father passed. My mother remarried.
Yeah.
My stepfather, unbeknownst to me, came with a guitar that he put in the hall closet that I never ever saw.
What kind?
It was a...
Like an old Harmony or
something?
Yeah,
it was a Harmony FO archtop tobacco sunburst guy, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Silver, maybe a Harmony or a silver tone.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, and one day in the house, I, you know, discovered it. And then next door to me, these kids... these people were from North Carolina, and their farm went down that year. And so the youngest two boys were sent up from North Carolina to Springfield, Massachusetts to be with their older brother.
Right.
And so springtime comes, you know, we started talking across the fence to one another. Well, what you do? Well, he asked, the first question was, do you have a wheel? I said, what you mean by a wheel? He said, a bicycle.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, I got a bicycle. He said, oh, he said, good. We said, you play baseball? I said, okay, I'm okay playing baseball.
Yeah.
He said, well, he said, you got a bat or a glove? I said, I got a bat and a ball. He said, well, I got a glove. He said, you know, hit me sometime.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, I play guitar. Not even guitar, but guitar.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I got a guitar. He said, well, let me see your guitar. So I ran in the house and brought the guitar out and came over to the fence. And he said, wait a minute. He said, you got a pair of pliers?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I got some pliers.
Yeah.
And so I went and got the pliers and then come back. By the time I got back, he had unwound the G-string.
Uh-huh.
It was a wound G-string.
Yeah.
And he took the pliers and he pulled that string, pulled all that wire off the G-string. He said, now you see here? That's the secret. He said, and don't tune it up so tight.
That's the thing. Taking the wire off the G-string?
Yeah. Yeah, because it gave you an unwound G and you could bend it and make him whine.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, you know.
And that was the trick? Same tuning, though. No different tuning.
No. Tune down maybe a step, a half step, a step lower.
And he taught you some tricks?
He just taught me, to play the basic good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then my neighbors up the street, they were from Clarksdale, Mississippi. Actually, from Stovall.
Uh-huh.
And I could go up there and ask Ernest Nichols, Ernie, when you get through playing what you playing, would you play Boogie Chiller? And he said, all right. And he would play it. And he'd get up there and play it, and it would sound just exactly like John Lee Hooker on the record.
And Kev, when you start recording on your own, it was almost like you were doing something historical. Like you were doing, you were honoring like a tradition that was pretty specific. Is that true?
That's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, I didn't have time because while he was, during his part of his life when he heard Boogie Chillin'
at
a young age, I heard Jamaica Farewell.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, me too,
Calypso.
Though.
You know what I mean?
Me too.
I heard all these, you know, Stevens, Calypso and Latin, Mongo, Santa Maria.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Things like that. That's what I was listening to and trying to play Motown.
Right.
Yeah. So blues was like later on, it was like, when I heard Taj, it was kind of like, you know, that was the awareness came in. And it was like,
well, that first record, that first Taj Mahal record, that thing is raw, kicks ass. I just listened to that again yesterday.
Yeah.
And it's so wild because the production in the late 60s, it was like, you know, it was all, it felt like it was all happening.
Oh, it was. That, it was.
That's
no, that was what it was. I mean, yeah. It was literally this. I was with the Rising Suns. We were all individually signed.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was a fiasco because none of us really knew much about the music business.
Right.
And they got the wrong type of people to represent us. So it was kind of crazy. We just ultimately, you know, even though we recorded all this music, it just was impossible to try to put anything together. And from the record company side, we had too much variation.
Yeah.
You know, we were a bunch of different guys that came from lots of different traditions, and we created a music together.
Yeah.
I mean, a year and a half, 2 years after we did what we did, everybody pretty much got on that same kind of train, you know.
Was bringing a lot of different stuff together.
Right, exactly. You know, and being, you know, everybody being like a songwriter, yeah. You know, and that kind of thing. But I moved off of that thing with the Rising Suns, and I was like maybe the only one that was on the record label.
Yeah, which label was this?
Columbia.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I wanted to do something. So I literally called up the then president of the record company, who was Clive Davis.
Yeah.
And left a message for him saying that, you know, I'd like to talk to him about making the record. And he did the business, I did the music.
This is the first record.
Yep, and although his name appears as the producer, ultimately he didn't have to produce me in the sense of say, okay, Tosh, here's a tune for you to do, and here's some other tunes, and what about those two tunes that he just completely left me alone.
So you chose all the tunes.
I chose everything. And then the other thing that happened in terms of that was that the musicians, I didn't have a band, so I had just had gone and heard, I don't know how long before that session, I had heard Jesse Davis playing with a band up in Topanga Canyon, and I just knew this guy could play.
Yeah.
He had, because I didn't want somebody, was a derivative of the way people play, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted somebody who had their own sound. And of the blues.
Right.
And he had his own sound of the blues, own feel.
But when you started, so you started with Calypso, basically, with that kind of music?
As far as playing live, what I was listening to was different than what I was
what
actually
were you playing? What was your first gigs doing live stuff? Like, who were you working with?
The Young Calatino Steel Band from Compton, California.
That was the first one? And you were playing the steel drum on that?
Yes.
And then you started playing Calypso guitar?
No, I never played Calypso guitar.
No.
But my uncle who taught me, Herman Wyatt, who lived up in Cupertino at the time, he started teaching me how to
Cupertino.
Play guitar.
Yeah.
He started teaching me finger picking on his nylon guitar. And the first song he taught me was, you know, how to play a Jamaica Farewell finger picking.
Right,
in
right.
Key of C.
When did you start, you know, working in a studio with guys?
My first session was I think I was a flop on my first session. It was a steel drum session.
Yeah.
And a producer came down and picked me up and from Compton.
Yeah.
And took me at the Gold Star Recording Studios with my steel pan.
Yeah.
And the Wrecking Crew was in there.
Really?
I didn't let them. They was in there playing. It was the Wrecking Crew.
Right.
And Carol Kay was on the bass in there.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know, at the time, I didn't know it was the Wrecking Crew. Just a bunch of, later on, I was oh, shit, that was the Wrecking Crew.
What were they doing? You don't know what they were doing?
I have no idea. I'm 14 years old. I was like 14. I knew what they were doing. I didn't even know what I was doing. They needed somebody to play a steel drum, and they had heard it. There was one down in Compton, and I was the guy that was, I guess I was the best player in the band.
Yeah.
And I could play the pan. So he got the pan, put it in the car.
Yeah.
And it was weird because he asked me to play, and because the guy that tuned the drums, he tuned them to like an alto saxophone. So when they said what key was in, I started playing the key and I was in the wrong key.
Oh, no. So you're the kid in the wrong key.
But really, my first real recording experience was probably playing with Papa John Creech.
He played with Jefferson Airplane?
Yeah.
In
71.
And what were you playing on that record?
Guitar.
So you moved up, you got out of the drum.
By that time, I'd been in some cover bands and in high school from playing the French horn. A bunch of guys wanted to make a cover band. There was one guitar player guy, so they had an amp, and so they said, we need another guitar player. So they knew I played a little guitar, so they got me. And I just learned the songs as they went.
Right, just standards, pop hits?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I learned, and what I didn't know, the other guy would teach me because he had guitar lessons at the Compton Music Center.
Oh, all right.
And so
And that's how you came to the guitar.
Yeah, I came to the guitar. So I came into the guitar from the steel drum, from through the French horn, through the jazz band, which I played percussion in.
You were playing drums too, or just like
percussion, like congas?
Right. Okay.
Conga.
So you're like both. You're both multi instrumentalists.
Well, in the steel band, there was drums, steel bands, steel drums, bass, all the way through cellos.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Other cello bands.
Yeah, and so I learned to play the drums. I learned to play the congas and the bongos and every arrangement they have had in there.
And then you became a guitar wizard later.
I wouldn't call myself a wizard, but I...
Yeah, you're kind of a wizard. Yeah, you guys are you're magicians.
But I started playing guitar with Papa John's. Yeah. And that was an accident because he was on, it was on Adams Boulevard down in between Crenshaw and
Brea. Right, yeah, yeah.
And there was a little soul food joint called the Jet Set Cafe.
Yeah.
And we would rehearse like two doors down from it. And one day, Papa John Creech and Roger Spotts and Miles Grayson were walking down the street on the way to get some soul food. And they heard us rehearsing in this little makeshift studio on Adams. And they came in. And next thing we know, we was playing on the Filthy Funky record.
With Papa John.
With Papa John.
So what was your relationship with with some of the guys that you were listening to? I know that early on, I know this. I don't remember which album of yours it is where you got a picture of you and Mississippi John Hurt on the cover. Now, were you able to actually learn from those guys one-on-one?
No, I didn't. Mostly with John Hurt was watching him play, because that's how I learned how to play.
Right.
I'm a Taurus. You know, I'm from Missouri. Not really, but I'm from Missouri, and you got to show me.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? I need to. It's like, you know, it's like I remember my dad trying to teach me something. He was a math whiz.
Yeah.
He was trying to deal with me with math, and it's like, okay, you can talk all that stuff out there in fantasy land you want.
Yeah.
But if you put 12 oranges in front of me and you take away 4, I know.
I understand.
There's 8 there.
Yeah, yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
That's how I work.
Yeah.
So Mississippi John, I went every opportunity he played some little coffee house somewhere to hear him. And then I had his records. I had his, you know, records. And then I listened to some. I was lucky enough every now and then to hear some of his old records.
Yeah.
So you hear how much they were playing different back at the time. Because by the time we got to him, he was probably like in his 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, late 60s and the 70s. And that picture that is on the Recycling the Blues and Other Related Stuff album.
Yeah.
Is I'm 19 and he's 76.
Wow. So he was your guy. You thought that was
well,
it.
Well, no, I mean, what was the real thing was, is that as a young black man in the 60s, when everybody was getting pretty violent, and there was the cities were burning, and basically people said, draw a line, you either over here or you over there. And it's like, no, that don't really work. You know, it isn't only two things. This is a big world.
Yeah.
And there's other things in it. But I needed somebody in whose music I could work with that would focus me and center me.
Yeah.
And I figured that this guy's living in the middle of Mississippi, and he's playing that gentle and that beautiful, then I'm going to have to learn how to calm down in the midst of, chaos.
Yeah.
And learn how to do this.
Yeah.
And so that's why I was just so thrilled to meet him and see him, because I avoided a lot of crazy stuff. A lot of people got caught up in them 60s, you know, and lost their life and incarcerated and had to make some terrible decisions. And I just was focused on the music, focused on the culture of the music, focused on my responsibility as a musician from ancient times.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, what would I be responsible for if I was a musician? You know, to keep the culture moving forward.
Yeah.
Have information. And so I got about the business of that. And
you realize that at that age?
Oh, yeah.
That this was the journey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, to stay in this. It's almost a spiritual journey,
too.
Oh,
yeah. The input came in earlier, but the actual practical application came, you know, as I started out recording. And particularly after the first 3 records, because, you know, what was going on in the world was like the British invasion.
Right.
And nobody was listening to the musicians here in the United States.
To the real guys.
Yeah. I mean, not only the real guys, but the younger guys that came after the Real Guys, like myself
right.
and others, they weren't listening to us.
Like, who would you put in that list?
John Hammond.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
You know, Ry Cooder.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Siegel Schwall Blues Band.
Yeah.
You know, Blues Project. They just were not giving a, they would just turn and went like, oh, it's all coming from England. And they didn't get listen to us. And so after about three records, I went like, you know what? I'm not going to just stay in this spot. I hear more music. I have a bigger cultural, you know, activity than all of that. And so I'm going to get out there and turn people on to what else is out here.
Right. You
know, this is not a monolith.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it ain't, I came over on a boat and I picked cotton. Now I play guitar. No.
No.
That's a little bit too limiting.
Well, and they, I guess that the reason that the British guys were, they just made it, what did they do? Were they make, they made hits out of it? They,
no, not so much that. They did that too. But it just was that American people, it's like anything else. Your
yeah.
parents will talk to you, you don't hear them. Your uncle talks to you,
yeah.
you hear them. Your aunt talks to you, you hear it.
Right.
And it's like, it's just the familiarity of it. They don't really get it. Nobody said that you should hear this.
Right,
you
right.
know, until somebody like Ellis came on and they went like, oh.
Oh, maybe we oh, should hear okay. it.
Well, maybe we should. Yeah, exactly. yeah. I mean, because, I mean, for a long time, a lot of people were like, very upset about the whole Elvis appropriating black music.
Right.
But when I think it was Richie Havens was saying one day, he said, yeah, but consider it from this point of view, because he did it, you know, he said, everybody that was around him didn't think that that was the thing for, you know, a young white guy to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, but what he did was open the door for a whole lot of other folks to come through.
Right.
And I mean, that's, you have to take it from that point of view, because if you look at it historically, look what happened after that.
Yeah.
I mean, America's music went completely over to the other side.
Broke it open.
Oh, broke it wide open.
And some of those British dudes, they were always, you know, respectful and
right.
inclusive, and
right.
they honored
right.
their heroes, right. certainly, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to, like, those that original Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green.
Right.
That guy fucking kills me.
Yeah.
The way he plays guitar.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, and then they sat down. They did session stuff with Otis Spann.
Sure.
And with, yeah, and they kind of gave it back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was the whole thing. I mean, in the rock and roll circus situation, I mean, it came, we were playing one night at the Whiskey a Go-Go. I was playing harmonica with my eyes closed. I opened my eyes and looked down on the floor, and there's Mick Jagger dancing. There's Keith Richards dancing. You know, there's Brian Jones dancing. Over here, the Animals are dancing. This is, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah,
whoa.
Right?
Now okay. So then I get off the stage, and I go over and say to him, you know, I ain't bringing my, I have bloody good, you
yeah,
know, blah,
yeah.
blah, blah, blah. And I said, listen, you know what? I don't know what you guys got in the water over there, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And if I'm hearing from some of my friends that you guys are really doing a lot of different stuff and you're communicating and playing with other people. If you ever have a project that you want, you know, us to be involved, you know, this band right here, I said, me, you know, I said, you know, just give us a holler.
Did they?
3 months later, 8 tickets, first class on BOAC.
Yeah.
And we never reached our hands in our pocket for anything else other than to buy chewing gum, cigarettes, or gifts that you were going to bring back home.
Yeah.
Those guys treated us like we were royalty.
And you toured.
We toured over
all
there.
All over Europe?
Them. A little bit.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. But we're not with them. We did the rock and roll circus, and that's when Jesse Davis met John Lennon, and
yeah.
John fell in love with Jesse's playing, and, you know, a whole lot of different stuff happened from that. It was pretty exciting.
It's an amazing time, man.
Oh,
and
yeah.
John Hammond, coming back around to Keb, I, you know, I saw the weirdest thing. I was in Tucson, Arizona, and I was, my brother lived there, and the Tucson, Arizona Blues Society was having a night with John Hammond, right? And I'm like, what the? Because I love Hammond. I think he's great.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, I'm in town. I'll go check this out. There must have been 30, 40 people there, and John Hammond with a national, you know, dobro, and he played, you know, to the note, Robert Johnson's Hellhound on My Trail.
Yeah.
And I never, like, I only heard Robert Johnson do it, and it's a weird song, right?
Yeah.
It's almost like a fragment. But he channeled Robert Johnson in that moment, and I never, it's so rare to hear that thing played, you know, note to note. in real time, like it's supposed to sound like. And it was mind-blowing to me. It was like the I understood why he's the window in, why Robert Johnson is the portal in.
Right, right.
And you seem like on some of your records that there was an actual, like, you I think you kind of channeled him too on some of those stuff, right?
Yes, I did. Right at that time, I mean, like, given the times where I was, I realized I had to do something different than what I was doing.
Which was the from the Calypso or the Caribbean?
From blues. I had gotten to blues. I had started a journey because I did a record in 1980.
Yeah.
And then after that, I got into 83. I got in a blues band called the Whodunit Band.
Yeah.
And then from there, I started to go backwards. They were doing like Chicago, more B.B. King, St. Louis things.
Yeah.
Then I started to go back and back and back. And then when I stumbled on Robert Johnson, and it was the same day I learned, heard Robert Johnson, heard Big Bill Broomzy.
Yeah.
And you have to understand, I ain't heard none of this stuff. It's like,
How old were you?
I was like 39.
Yeah. Oh, really? And you hadn't gone there before?
I just wanted to be a background. I wasn't trying to be
the main guy.
Front man.
I mean, if I was a front man, it was out of sheer, I just wanted somebody to sing my songs, but no one would sing it. I would sing them.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be a songwriter.
Right.
So I said, I heard this guy, and so the light went on. All of a sudden, like, you know, that door that was open when Taj Mahal came to high school.
Yeah.
There. And all of a sudden, when I heard Big Bill and Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what blues is supposed to sound like.
Right.
Because I've been hearing club blues.
Right.
Right.
The club. You know, going jamming, people come, let's just play some blues.
Right, right.
But okay, well, let's play that. Let's play Stormy Monday. Let's play Shade Street Mechanic. Let's play this. And you play it, but it was not with the same reverence and regard that when you heard, you know, Mississippi John Hurt playing or Lance Mance Lipscomb.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just doing, when you heard them guys, it's like, no, wait a minute, that's different. That's not that's not like that other stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's like
real. There was no Hollywood. Right, there was no Hollywood in it.
Yeah.
Right. No cliches.
You know?
No cliches. And the bars were not 16 or 12 or 8. It was like, could be 19.
Yeah.
It could change in the song, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, you changed it. Yeah. Yeah, Lightning used to tell them guys that tried to play, he said, listen to him. You change when Lightning changes.
You've got to follow him.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you started to approach that Robert Johnson stuff, I mean, there is no precedent for it, right? It was
there was no, and it changed. You see, in that moment, it was a defining moment where my head changed.
Oh right? Yeah.
You see, now I'm not, because it wasn't like all of a sudden somebody. It was like, no, there was a path from 1983 to 1990,
yeah,
you know, 1991,
yeah,
where this thing was taking place, where all of a sudden then that one, I was ready to really hear that,
yeah,
it was played, and also too, you know, I got into, and then right after that, I got involved in theater,
yeah,
you know, when I met Chick Streetman, who ultimately introduced me to Taj Mahal.
Who's that guy?
Chick Streetman.
Yeah, very interesting character.
What's he do?
In Seattle.
Guitar player.
Yeah.
Songwriter.
Yeah.
He co-wrote All Around the World with me on the record there.
Okay.
So he introduced me to Taj. You know, so all this is happening in the same 2-year period. And because in theater, what's great about that is, you know, I was in this play called Rabbit Foot at the L.A. Theater Center.
You were acting.
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, I was a musician in the play.
Okay.
I was
acting.
But in that, I got a call from Shabaka Henley, who's an actor named Shabaka Henley.
Yeah.
And he said, I need a guitar player to play this role in this Rabbit Foot, and a guy named Quentin Denard recommended you. He said, you was the guy.
Yeah.
But I wasn't the guy.
No, you wasn't?
But he thought I was the guy. So I said, let me check my schedule. And I asked him a few questions like, okay, so when is this starting? How long is the rehearsal? Oh, we rehearsed for 4 weeks, bingo.
Yeah.
I got 4 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. So you took it.
I took it. I went down to McCabe's in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
And met a guy named Fran Banish, and he started like schooling me and put me together. Meanwhile, I was handed this cassette of about 20 songs that were like that I'd never heard before.
From who?
From Muddy Waters to like people I can't even, just
Petey Wheatstraw.
Yeah, all the stuff
that
I had to listen to. So you have to understand, like, so this was like a divine kind of
thing
that happened to me that was orchestrated from the universe, my opinion.
This theater gig, and then all of a sudden you're handed the history that you needed, all the things.
And 4 weeks to
Yeah, to study. It was the Rosetta Stone of the blues. It was all there. Yeah.
Oh, wait,
you
that's
need.
Not all.
Yeah.
Right after that,
yeah.
I hadn't really met Chick yet.
Yeah.
You know, right after that, I go, they need an understudy for Spunk, which is George Wolfe, you know.
Yeah.
The director, George Wolfe.
Yeah, I've talked to him.
It's Mark great. Taper, you yeah. know. So he was the director I had to go audition for. Him.
Yeah.
And he said, nah.
Not the guy.
I mean, I was just coming. He's just like, I don't know, but this is all going on behind my, you know, not in the presence of me. And Chick was the role. He said, no, I think you ought to hire this guy because he's going to learn it.
Yeah.
He'll do it.
Yeah.
For some reason, Chick, without knowing me, backed me up.
Yeah.
And so they gave me the gig.
And what was the role exactly?
It was Guitar Man.
Oh, yeah.
Spunk. Now, I got another, about another 7 weeks with pay.
Yeah.
To understudy, more music, more studying. Plus, I'm working under a guy named George Wolfe.
Yeah, he's a great
where I
genius.
Get to listen to all of his notes.
Yeah,
all when he's giving notes to all the actors and notes to while they're doing and everything that he's doing, and the background on archetypes and things and the characters. It's like all of a sudden now this thing got really
big.
So all of a sudden I had a master course in a period of about 4 months. That was amazing.
On basically what took you to the beginning of it.
Yeah, and then once I came out of that, then that's who you met.
Yeah.
The day when Chick took me down to meet John Porter.
Yeah, yeah. We were in the studio recording Dancing the Blues.
Richard Perry's old studio.
Yeah, it? Yeah. That they originally recorded, Bing Crosby recorded White Christmas in that studio.
Yeah.
Memorabilia. Well, you know, you were saying something about that Robert Johnson tune.
Yeah.
Hellhound on My Trail.
Yeah.
You know what that is?
No.
And this is very interesting. Is that it's clear and obvious he had listened to Skip James, because that tune is Skip James.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds,
right. Yeah. So it's all the notes.
It sounds like Skip James number.
But he plays it a lot faster. Skip is from Bentonia.
Yeah.
Bentonia, Mississippi. Yeah. Around Bell's on there, around that area. And they have a whole other, they got the what I call the Mandinka Lope in their music.
Yeah.
Is this guitar happening?
Here, this one is.
Which one? I'll show you what I'm talking about. The Series Mandinka Lope. You know, which is like this. So you get this thing in here. We got two.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, that's that.
Wow.
That's the Mandinka Lope.
Oh, that's it.
You know, that represents people who walk, they have donkeys, they have camels, goats, chickens, and that's how they move around, carts. And so that movement is in the way they play the music. Plus, when they like go a long distance over anywhere, and they're going, you got to have a song that you can play all day long,
right?
And not get tired. Yeah.
And that's where
keeps cycling itself around. You know, whereas like some blues, when it gets into being patterned, I remember little brother Montgomery was saying. He said, "Well, you know." You know how it is. Some of these fellows, they play that pattern blues. In other words, everything's patterned and cliched. He said they're not really writing a song.
Right.
And this guy, he's famous for a tune called the Vicksburg Blues, or 44.
Yeah.
The Vicksburg Blues is one of the classic pieces of music. If I ever get the opportunity, I want to have John Cleary play it on piano. And have a symphony orchestra playing behind it, and I want to walk out in a swallowtail, you know, tuxedo and sing that song. And, you know, I mean, because it's fabulous the way he laid it out, because he really wrote it's a written piece of music. You know, it's just like what Scott Joplin did with Ragtime is what little brother Montgomery did with blues.
Right.
You know? And another thing is because he's a Creole from New Orleans.
Right.
The blues came down the river from Mississippi.
Right.
Into that environment. That's why it's a flavor. Even when they take it as a blues, it still is different. It's more melodic.
Right.
You know, because the blues is like you can get the whole plate.
Yeah.
You know, like Big Bill Brunsey or Big Joe Williams, nine string Big Joe Williams. You know, it's like the blues.
Yeah.
And then you go somewhere else where it's like a flavor.
Right.
You know, or a side dish.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or, you know, or
you can hear it in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Basic. You can hear the blues in basic.
Oh, of course, yeah.
You know, count basic.
Yeah,
you know?
I've been listening to, who am I listening to? Lee Morgan, the Jazz Messengers.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Blues all up
blues.
In there.
All blues.
All up in
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Well, that stuff that you were just playing, you tracked that down, like, you know, you hit, you know, your that moment with Robert Johnson, but you went further back, right?
It tracked me down. It tracked me down.
Because
there's the world, the modern world that we know.
Yeah.
And if you go back far enough, it you know, the sunrise is on the ancient world, which is still out there.
Sure.
People are still connected to that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, it's very easy on this side of that, you know, that semi-permeable membrane to think this is it.
Right, right.
No, 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 no.
Yeah.
You're in the wrong taxi.
But where does that come, where does that groove that you just, is that Senegal? Where does that come from?
It's a Songhai Empire.
Yeah.
A groove. Mauritania, Senegal, Gambia.
Yeah.
Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger.
Yeah.
That whole area right there.
Right. And that's where it all came up to here.
Oops, yeah.
Involuntarily.
Well, yeah, involuntarily. Yeah, right. But it came in. And banjo, you know, it's from that same area too.
And when did you go down there and spend time down there?
Yeah, I always spent time there.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, it was like it's like a connection that you just have to constantly be a part of. And once you hear that, all this other stuff hooks up to it. You know, my point was to be like to know like the 500 years of music that developed after Africans were brought into the Western world.
Yeah.
Okay? So that in the possibility, or maybe 350 years, that one day I would actually hook up with them cats, I have something to say.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's like, because some people have developed their music so modernly that they can't communicate that anymore.
Just hearing you play that one riff for 2 minutes, I'm like, it's like time travel. It's
exactly,
like,
exactly.
Yeah,
you hit it right on the head.
It's transcendent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What do you think about, like, you know, how things were produced back when you were starting out? Because like it was kind of stunning to me when I listened to the first record that it sounded like a Chess record almost. So I could say, you know, and now it seems that things have gotten so complicated that it's hard to get back to that raw shit.
No, it's not hard at all.
No.
No, you go through and listen to my records. You hear it.
Oh, no, yeah, I know.
It stayed raw.
Yeah.
No, but the whole point of it is that everybody was playing. Those records were almost out, probably until the third record.
Yeah.
We hardly had any overdubs.
Right.
That was like, playing harp, they're playing, the band's playing. We decided how the record's going to go, the tune's going to go.
Yeah.
And what everybody's going to play. It's like, when that record opens up with Leaving Trunk,
yeah,
I walked up to the bass player. And the two people I didn't tell anything about what to play was Jesse Davis and Ry Cooder. They didn't need to hear anything.
Right.
They play by instinct.
Yeah.
That was what was so great about Ry. Ry had some of the best instincts of any of the young players at the time.
And you only had a certain amount of time in the studio, I bet.
Well, we were good. I'm not somebody who likes to rehearse in the studio.
Yeah.
So I knew that I needed to really have this thing made. I think we made that album for like $16,000 or something like that back then. You know, and so what I did was I walked in to the bass player and I said, look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go boo 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 doo 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 doo. Drummer, come on, boo boo doo 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 doo. And once I got them said, I said, and now say that all the way through the whole record and put yourself in there where you want.
Yeah.
And then they said, well, how are we gonna open it up? I said, okay, here's how to open it is. And I put that bebop lick on the front.
Right.
Scoop da 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 We're off. Band's chucking.
Yeah, yeah.
Cylinders are popping, man. Dance is going, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now I'll throw the lyrics on there.
And that was it.
It was for Sleepy John Estes. Because that's what I was supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Taking the old music and bringing it into my time.
And that was that's the whole journey right there.
Yeah, right there.
Now, both of you guys, like, let's talk about certain songs because, like, there are certain songs that you've recorded two or three times, like, I think, like, Further On Down the Road, maybe?
Yeah.
And, Come On In My Kitchen, right? What is it about that tune? You know, because that's one of those tunes that, like, you know, you've both recorded it, right?
Yeah. But you always hear more.
Yeah. Is that it?
Yeah. Whatever your lesson is at the time that you learn, you know, because you can go in and you can, like, completely play exactly the way you hear it.
Yeah.
Okay, and you're happy with that for a while. Then after a while, you're not so happy with that. You know, and then but you're not aware that something's marinating in you. And then one day, all of a sudden you hear it. And you got to record the different version of it.
Yeah, because sometimes fresh ideas can rot like food.
Yeah.
They like, they play them, especially the danger of having familiar music or some of what people call hits.
Yeah.
You know, I've never had a hit.
Right.
Me neither.
I kind of like it like that. I mean, yeah. I wouldn't turn one down, but no. I kind of like the fact that I don't have one.
Because
there's a certain freedom that involves it. You know?
Well, you don't have to follow it up.
Yeah. But even though there's certain songs that you have to play for your audience.
Right.
And then, like last year,
there's
a couple of songs that I play that always work that I was playing, and it got to about 2 weeks before the end of the tour, and it's like, that got to go.
Yeah.
not because there's because I was my tiredness, my fatigue of the idea was beginning to show in my performance.
Right, you felt it. Yeah,
you know what I mean?
You're faking
it. Then when I began to see hints of it with the audience, I had to just cut it loose because it's then if that's a big hit, and you start to get that feeling.
You can never stop playing.
That's when the needle comes in.
Right.
That's when the pills start coming in.
Now
you're eating, now you're delivering rotten ideas.
Right, you're a parody of yourself.
Right.
You're just a cover band of you.
Yeah. You don't want to start
feeling that, and it's just really...
Shit.
So Come In My Kitchen.
Yeah.
You're talking about that song. Yeah. Sometimes it just takes going back and listening to the
original.
Yeah.
The original. And so why do I like that song so much? Even a song that you do.
Yeah.
That you got sick of.
Yeah.
You go back and listen to it. Like, why do they like that?
Yeah.
You know?
And
if you can't find it, you got to cut it loose. That's why Barbara Streisand doesn't sing People anymore.
Yeah. But like there's something about those songs though. There's something about like Love in Vain, Come On In My Kitchen, and like for me, for years, and again, I'm not a professional musician, but I thought that in order to be a real blues guy, you've got to figure out how to do Rolling and Tumbling. You've got to figure out how to play that song.
Well, there's a lot of different ways to play it.
That's the thing. Yeah,
that's the point.
You've got to figure out how to make that one your own.
Yes, right. Well, all of them. Yeah. All those songs.
Yeah.
You have to make all the songs your own.
Figuring out why that works and then figuring out what works for you on it. Because you can't copy those guys.
That's all you're doing. Yeah.
You're just copying.
Well, yeah, but see, some places, I'll tell you was it Jackie McLean?
Yeah.
Jackie McLean is an alto player.
Yeah.
And everybody used to say, but he sounds just like Bird. And Jackie said, yeah, that's because I really just wanted to sound like Bird. I didn't care about nobody else. He wasn't trying to sound like nobody else.
Yeah.
But the whole point was that the majority of people that we grew up listening to, there was such a variety of musicians that had their own signature. I mean, it's like, you know, Cat comes on, he ain't played two notes and I know who it is. Now, the newer crowd of people, the music that they're listening to, they may play and I don't know who the heck that is.
Yeah.
Because it's just not, it doesn't have any kind of personality to it.
It's like the bar band blues.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like they're you know, like the weird thing about the blues is that they're beautiful and that anyone can kind of play them, but to make them your own, that's a whole different thing. And that's the whole difference, right? Because you can't, like you were saying, you're just playing in cover bands or just these bands that are just playing these blues, Bobby Bland, whatever it is. It's like a pretty good band can get through all that shit. But to really make it your own, it's that one thing you can't describe, right?
Right. Yep. Well, a lot of it is that I think that people don't recognize that these bands came out of the same area and basically had the same kind of nomenclature and language, which moved itself over to the music that they were playing.
Yeah.
And so they actually are having a conversation inside of the music.
Within the band.
Within the band.
Yeah.
And see, this is what doesn't happen with a lot of guys who come in and go like, you know, we want to play some blues.
Yeah.
You know, they don't understand. That's a conversation that you have to relax and come from totally deep within.
Right, and now there's a few steps removed generationally, who they listening to. Like, you know, because like it took me, I was older already. I was in my 40s before I really understood that, you know, the Hubert Sumlin, Howlin' Wolf thing. And it's like, what? You know, because I know Jimmy Vivino, because I do Conan O'Brien sometimes.
Oh,
and
yeah,
Jimmy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, did that last album with Hubert, one of the last ones.
Yeah.
And just to hear what he was doing on guitar and to really isolate it and realize that the two of them and the rest of them, but like that conversation that you're talking about, you can't, there's nothing, it's singular. It's all, there's no one else going to do that.
Yeah.
And did you know Hubert? You guys knew him?
Yeah.
I used to do the Wolf part for Hubert.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. We played he was playing at the Long Beach Blues Festival.
Yeah.
They called me up and said, hey, listen, you know, we got Hubert here and he sounds good, but he just don't sound like that. I said, well, okay. I said, I'll do my best Wolf impressions for you. And Hubert lit up like a tree.
Yeah,
because that was the
shape
combination.
For me?
Was the dynamic.
Oh, yeah.
It was had to go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. And also, Wolf stopped Hubert from playing with a pick.
Oh, he told him on purpose?
He said, man, don't play with me. Because Hubert was decided that he was going to try to play with a pick.
Yeah.
Wolf said, play with your natural fingers. With your natural fingers. And Hubert, the stuff that Hubert played.
It's crazy.
Going down slow.
Yeah,
listen to the guitar on that.
It's crazy,
one of some of the best solos I ever heard anybody play.
Right. Yeah, and he lived a long time, huh?
Oh, yeah.
So what, when you guys, what made this album happen? The new one, the one that you guys did, the one that you're out doing.
Well, what made it happen, it started happening years ago.
How
so?
Well, it's like, you know, it's the result of everything I did, everything he did.
Yeah.
Everything all the people that before us did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything before them.
Yeah.
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 All the people that were born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That related
the
to
history
all,
of
the
people.
The whole thing. The guy that happened to be playing steel drums on my block. The guy that had the guitar that happened to be in his closet.
Yeah.
And then all the conversations that I heard Taj.
Yeah.
You know, talk about when he didn't know I was listening.
Yeah.
I'm glad somebody will listen.
Listening, you know, things like, you know, ancestral things that happen, like, you know, like about the, you know, when you work when working those work songs, working on the Delta, songs that you can work all day and not get tired.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, like being a musician, like you can play all day and not know you worked.
Right. That's the best day, right?
Hello.
Yeah, you know, you're doing something you love. You work all day. You know, you don't know you're working.
Yeah.
You don't know.
That's right.
So this was just a destiny, almost.
It's just kind of. I can't even answer. So basically, I can't even answer that question.
Right.
But the short answer is, we were in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Greg Allman tribute. May he rest in peace.
Yeah, may he rest in peace. Yeah.
We were at the bar at the hotel, and I said, "Well, what do you think about us doing a record together?" And there wasn't one answer was yes, whether he was serious or not.
Yeah.
My answer was yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But he was serious.
Yeah.
And so I knew it was going to happen, though. See, because I mean, you know, you can tell when people like be, you know, fluffing past your ears, you know, and blowing smoke up your skirt.
Yeah.
You know, no, this was going to happen. And to me, it's like in my life, I can't just stay at the same place, gigging on the road. That's why I'm always doing different stuff, because I see that there's more information out there. And I figured that, you know, what would happen between us working you know, would be great for both of us as individuals.
Yeah.
And what we would put together would be something that everybody would probably in their wildest fantasy were fantasizing that. Oh, what happened? If those two guys got this.
And it was a great departure for me because I was getting a little sick of myself. To be quite frank,
you're starting to drop into that almost a needle.
No,
that's where you know, like you finish your year out, and the next year you I don't even want to go out next year.
Right. You don't want to do the work.
What am I doing?
What am I doing?
What the heck am I doing?
And also, because we're in the set, we do actually a lot of songs from the record.
Yeah,
which is a big no-no when you have a back catalog people want to hear this and that and
fuck them,
but you said it, I didn't.
Well, no.
Thank you for saying that.
Right, because we don't ever have to say that.
You can't say that, and it's a loving fuck them. You know what
no,
I mean?
I didn't mean to be dramatic about the needle. We understand. Yeah, because you don't want to be a...
They won't grow if you don't do that.
Right, but they get so locked into that stuff, and when you go, we're going to do a couple new ones, they're like, no, let's go to the bathroom. And you're like, no, this is where we're growing.
Don't tell them what you're going to do. Just keep it coming, and all of a sudden they get comfortable, you know, because I mean, night after night, for me, I'm always going to play new tunes that they never heard.
Right.
I mean, the challenge is to get up in front of a bunch of people who never heard you and make some music that they get with. You know, and that, a lot of it is you relaxing and getting on your game.
Right.
Yeah. And you get on your, because I mean, I can go somewhere where I never heard a musician before, and if the cat is playing, I'm transfixed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know?
That's the best thing that can happen. I just went to Lincoln Center for the second time in my life, just on a whim, to see Wynton Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. And they're doing Monk tunes.
Oh, yeah.
Big arrangements. I can't remember his name. He was a Pakistani flautist on a wooden flute playing Monk. And I was like, I don't even understand what's happening, but I'm in.
Exactly.
And that guy from Brazil playing a bandolin, like Django Reinhardt.
Yeah, and I was
like, I don't need to know anything,
right?
But what's happening right now?
That's right.
And that's what you want, that connection to the audience to be.
Right. And when you go back and you listen, say to the recordings from I mean before this loss. But I mean, the popular recordings of jazz and popular jazz from the late 50s, let's say middle of the 40s on up to maybe almost the end of the 60s.
Yeah.
Man, there was so many creative people.
A lot.
I mean, it's like, I'm in a way, you know, it's a shame that they only got recorded and you know, are sitting in vault someplace.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad it got recorded.
It's out there somewhere.
I mean, it really is. It really is the output for people in the intellectual property, creativity is phenomenal.
There's so much now.
You know,
and there's enough that they keep.
And people used to listen, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was all over the place.
Yeah,
it's amazing that's what music used to be. You go to a dance and there'd be 20 guys on the bandstand. You know, like that was the band.
Yeah, right. 20. Or you'd have a band and they'd run 20 people through the band.
Right.
Everybody had two or three songs.
And we had time to listen.
Right. Yeah.
We still have it. We just don't think we have it.
Yeah.
We're trying to keep up with other sidetracked. Big time.
We've been bamboozled.
Yes, we have.
We've been bushwhacked. We've been snockered. We've been snowjogged. And we could keep on going on that railroad. But you knew this ship was going to Shanghai when you got on it.
Well, it seemed like the record, when I listened to it, like it makes total sense knowing more about you and knowing what you're into, that, you know, you both have this range of experience with different musical styles that they're all just going to weave in and out. You know what I mean?
People have that. They just don't know it because...
Well, that's what your job is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They just don't know it. It's just that, you know, most people have been exposed primarily to, you know...
Popular music.
Yeah. I mean, I came to popular music long after what I heard.
Yeah.
You know, gospel music from my mother from the South.
Yeah.
Caribbean music from my father from the Caribbean. You know,
that's really funny because you're the same thing, though.
But gospel, a different way.
Caribbean.
Yeah,
the gospel from your family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my Caribbean experience came from down the street.
Yeah.
Well,
you just heard it.
Church, but a church. Yeah. We went to church every Sunday. You go to church. Yeah. Hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Church. Now we got off easy.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Some of them had to go to church every night.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They were making sure they knew where you were. You know. Yeah. Well, they weren't on two things open after midnight up in there. No, I'm serious, man. It's just so exciting, and people could have so much more. An expansive experience, you know, if they just get to hear what's out there and you know, not, you know, pull the blanket over the top of their head and look at their, you know, their cell phone and their listening device. I mean, that's it.
And it's all out there. That's the weird thing, because I just started, like, I grew up like that. I mean, I was turned on to blues and turned on to, you know, experimental music. I had people in my life that say, like the guy at the record store,
right,
that gives you the thing. You're like, what is this? And you bring it home, like, where does this even exist? You know?
Yeah.
And you get that experience. What the beautiful thing about music is that there's no late to the party.
No.
Because the party's always going on.
That's right.
And you can just go find it. And there's never a shortage. Like you were saying before, like, what the fuck is this? Yeah. And it's like all new.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No matter how old it is. Yeah. I just bought 3 Dizzy Gillespie albums. Yeah. I never listened to a Dizzy Gillespie album until last week.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he grew up like 3.5 miles from where my mother grew up in South Carolina.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, his Aunt Thelma delivered my Uncle Elmo.
Okay. I was just out on tour with the Hendrix Experience.
Oh, with Zappa? With Dweezil?
And Dweezil turned me on to all his dad stuff.
That's a whole other world.
Whole other thing. Zappa, the whole Zappa thing.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And told me the story about his dad, how he got into music. He taught himself everything, how to orchestrate, how to play instruments, by going to the library.
Yeah.
Have, like, you know.
Oh, that's Zappa world.
I remember when those kids were born, man.
Yeah? Were you over at the house?
Well, yeah. I used to hang out with Medusa back in those days.
Right. From the GTO.
Yeah.
So when did you come to L.A. the first time?
65. I came to L.A. and stayed. I never went.
From 65?
65 on, I've been out on the West Coast or somewhere out here.
So you knew all those guys?
All those characters.
Running around Laurel Canyon, the craziness?
That's when it started on that side. I mean, I used to be the bouncer at the Ash Grove.
Where's that?
You know where the Improv is?
On Melrose.
8162 Melrose Avenue. That used to be the Ash Grove. That was the hippest club in the United States of America.
What was there?
They played nothing but like Mississippi John Hurt, Booker White, Lightning Hopkins, Clifton Chenier.
And you were the door guy?
I was the doorman.
In 65, 66?
65. And then the Rising Sun started. And so I was only the door guy sometimes.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I was on stage, you know.
And so you were taking all that in.
Hey, man, for those guys to be playing, Joseph Spence, I mean, you name them, when they played there, the real stuff was there all the time.
So that was it. That was the mind-blowing experience, right?
Oh, yeah.
You
could find them at the, but see, back east, it was like the Newport Folk Festival.
Right.
You know, the Club 47 in Cambridge, you know, all that stuff down in New York, you know, and the cafes and
Bitter End and
Bitter
stuff.
Bitter End, yeah. And you know, Gertie's Folk City, all that New York stuff, you know, Cafe Wah. Mm-hmm. And then there was, you know, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, there's the Second Fret, there was the Turk's Head in Boston, there was, you know, there was a lot of folk clubs. And these guys, when they would come into the area,
Sonny Terry, Brian McGee,
they played lots.
Yeah,
lots.
They were all part of that folk scene.
Yep.
But I imagine that your time there in the mid-60s, just being there and working there and seeing all that shit every night, that must have just like opened it up.
Oh yeah, well, you got an idea that this wasn't just some, somebody's thesis that was gathering dust in the back of a university.
Right.
You know,
this is living music.
This is the living, breathing people.
Yeah.
Plus, they didn't come there and play one night. They came and then hung out for the week or two or three nights.
Yeah.
So you got a chance to relax into what it was that they were playing, and so did they. You know?
I saw Big Mama Thornton and Jonathan Swift's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah, I know John.
You played there, right? Too. Downstairs, right?
Yeah.
That became a comedy club, too, weirdly.
Oh, really?
Yep.
That was the place. I knew what happened to Jonathan Swift's. Robert Cray was opening for me. And I remember everybody was talking about Robert Cray. Have you seen Robert Cray? Robert Cray. So I finally got to hear the record. And was a Strong Persuader. I
think yeah.
It was the first one. And I said, yeah, get playing.
Yeah.
More of a soul blues sound.
Right.
You know.
Stratocaster, right?
Yeah,
straight
yeah,
up.
Yeah, yeah. So then he opened for me playing. I was playing solo. And he opened for me playing. The band got playing up on the stage. I said hello to him. The band got playing on the stage. And about the middle of the set, I came out of the back room. And I stood there and I looked up at him. And I didn't know what made him as nervous as it did.
Yeah.
But anyway, after the set, he came in, driving off. He said, wow, man, why'd you come out in the middle of the set and look at me like that? And I said, because my work is done. And he got it. He got it. I used to tease him because I used to tease Otis Clay because I said, you sure you ain't Robert Gray's daddy? Otis said, not like that. You sure you ain't Robert Gray's daddy?
You know, back, maybe I was talking about like 5 nights. Back then, I remember in my neighborhood down in the Parisian room, all those clubs.
Yeah, Parisian room, yeah.
Down there where, and the Ashgrove, because I lived around the corner from Ashgrove in 71. It was still going the last days of it.
Yeah.
And I went in there a couple times just to check and see what was going on.
Yeah.
And, but before the onset of high ticket prices and things like that, artists, you had to come, you'd play a week.
Yeah.
Carl McRae would be down there for a week.
Sure.
Jimmy Smith would come down there, he'd play for a week.
Yeah.
Oh, because to make it worth the trip, you got to play a week.
I went down to the apartment on the Honeycomb, and the Delphonics would come, and they'd play a week.
Wow. Yeah, and you get to hear them, to hear that beautiful music every night.
But to get enough people in there to keep them on the road.
Yeah. And then people probably see them two or three times, just keep coming back. And this is a weird question, because how do you not, because like a lot of blues, I guess I just I'm looking for a guitar lesson now. But I'm pretty good with the pentatonics and the licks and the riffs, but like, how do you get to the next place?
What place you talking about?
Well, like, how do I do what you just did for 2 seconds?
I don't know.
What I did is I deconstructed Skip James's, one of Skip James's tunes, and instead of, because he played an open D minor.
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
And which is the same thing that, I saw him there too. Albert Collins.
Yeah.
Albert Collins on a Telecaster cables up 5 or 7.
Yeah.
And plays in open D minor.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
When it's open down here, it's open D minor. Well, what I did is, it's all about listening to the music.
Yeah.
There's still actually one thing Robert Jr. Lockwood does that he learned from Robert Johnson that every once in a while it sneaks out. But you notice how when he's playing that the high string is always ringing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And it there's a certain kind of way you gotta be conscious of playing that way. But what I did was deconstruct Skip James into standard tuning.
Oh, okay.
And just figure out where the strings are sympathetically vibrating with one another.
Right, right.
All that older music is all about sympathetic vibration.
Right, right.
I mean, it's serious.
Yeah.
And they got no frets.
Right, right.
That's what's killing me.
Yeah.
I mean, perfectly in tune and no frets.
It's tricky.
Okay.
And you had there's even on this record, there's a lead on one of the songs that seems to, it feels like blues, but then you do these little calypso flourishes almost. I don't know what they are, but they, I don't know.
Well,
how
that's.
That's just in you. I don't know what I'm asking
you.
Well,
the thing about it is, for me, when I look at the Taj Mahal, any person who's been in the game as long as he's been in there.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I wake up to it at 40. I can't catch him.
Right.
Or anybody says, there's no way I'm going to catch him.
Right,
I
mean? Right.
So yeah, but I can't catch Chuck Berry.
You can now.
No, can't catch me,
but
man.
But you know, you're so like, you got to like go like, okay, who am I in this moment?
Right.
Right.
Who am I in this moment? And what do I need to do right now?
Yeah.
Right.
To get to where I need to go. So
right.
I picked a few guys. I picked Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson, Tampa Red, and Big Ben Bluesy, Muddy Waters.
Those are the guys.
I just went in on them guys.
Oh, okay.
Because I figured, and it was kind of like, if I could figure out the commonality between those four guys.
Yeah.
What they were doing and why it sounded like that.
Mm.
And, you know, plus having played a lot of, had a lot of singers. I had a lot of singers.
Yeah.
Well, which ones make the girls go crazy and which ones don't?
Right. That's very important in music.
Yeah. But you know what's interesting?
Yeah.
What you just said. Well, Whitaker was the only one that I think was out of the Delta. Robert was in the Delta. Muddy was in the Delta. And Big Bill Brunzy was like just across the river from the Delta in Arkansas. But Hudson Whitaker was from Florida.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that lady's name was Tampa.
Tampa.
And but where did he end up?
Where?
Chicago.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
That Chuck Berry thing, too.
Like I said, I'm going to never catch up with Taj Mahal.
But what you're saying, you take the sounds and you integrate them into your own thing, you know? But that Chuck Berry bounce, I don't know how he does it.
Oh, you
know,
it's perfect.
It's amazing.
It's perfect.
It's amazing.
It's perfect. It's perfect. It was perfect back then. It's perfect now. In fact, I got a chance to do one of his tunes recently on a John Lennon tribute.
Yeah.
And I was so thrilled.
Which one?
I did... Sweet Little 16.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
the band played perfect, man. Because, you know, I mean, it's funny. You know, it's really, if you go back and see, what you got to see is him doing it on Bandstand. Because he says, all over he takes the pick, all over St. Louis.
Yeah, yeah.
Just that move.
Yeah.
Man, Chuck had every single move where it was supposed to be.
I never understood how complex it was, really, but it is.
Play it like he's playing it.
Yeah, because I don't think he picks up. I think a lot of it's all down.
Downstroke, yeah.
Right, right, and it makes a big difference.
Yeah. Downstrokes like that, and then and with the drum shuffling.
Right,
right.
You know, and you think because his guitars is going like that, because most bands go, especially Johnny, you're going to go.
Right, right.
And
they got to swing a little.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A whole bunch of them different guys played drums on that. And what's really funny how Willie Dixon played bass on so much stuff.
On Chuck stuff?
You know, Chuck stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And but then, for me, it's all good. But man, when he had that electric bass on Nadine, I was done.
Yeah.
Nadine.
Yeah.
Nadine. And also, too, the moon glows on. Whoa.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
almost grown.
Whoa.
You know I'm doing all right in school? Wow. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see that movie with him and Keith?
Oh, yeah.
That was crazy. Like when Chuck is just schooling Keith Richards and they're fighting.
Well, no, but see, the trouble was that Keith made a terrible mistake. The mistake he made was that Chuck wasn't in the dressing room, and Keith went over to put his hands on Chuck's guitar.
And that was it.
Clock. He turned around, Chuck clocked him right in the eye. Clock. You know, like, and you know what? Keith was big enough man to say, "Hey, I deserved it.
Yeah.
He said I should have known better to put my hands on it."
Some people don't like you touching their guitar.
No,
I touched my one of my favorite guitar players. Probably my favorite guitar player is David T. Walker.
Oh yeah.
And like I touched his guitar one time, and he kind of said, "Well, you know, I kind of." Really don't like people touching my guitar that much.
That's better than a punch.
And it was kind of like a. It was a very friendly like.
Yeah.
Right. Rattlesnake.
I went.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Do you let people touch your guitar?
I don't like them.
Yeah.
I'm like, ask me if I think I want to. You can.
Yeah. It's interesting. Some people just go grab a guitar, other people don't.
There's certain things you just don't do.
It's funny because I've had a few musicians come over and I had this, I don't know if it was this one, maybe this one. I had a 335 in the living room once. And like, I always feel better if someone comes in and grabs it. Like, James Taylor came over and like right away, didn't even talk, just went over to the living room, started playing. I'm like, great, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
No, some people are like that.
Yeah. They just
not
can't.
Everybody.
There's one, I got to touch it. He didn't think that I would freak out.
Some people rent guitars.
They don't get attached to them.
They go up and they can rent. We just rent some guitars when we get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I guess some people are very attached to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you like Larry Carlton, you play. Larry Carlton has his guitar. You know, some people have their guitar.
Right.
They don't switch around.
Right.
It's like, this is my guitar. Like, David, he's like that.
Carlton's like that, Larry?
Yeah, they have very, very most, they have a very relationship. I don't know if it's like a don't touch my guitar thing, but he has a very personal relationship with his guitar.
Instrument, yeah.
Well, I guess BB did too, but I think there was a lot of Lucille's. There's it's quite, okay. Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Just don't touch the one he got in his hand or in the dressing room or the one sitting next to the one.
Sitting next to the one.
It's like, what was it? What Albert King says? If you put your hands on my Lucy, I don't know what I'm doing to you. I love Albert. Yeah, so Albert King did a lot of times too with the ass girl.
Yeah, with that flying V.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
Man, yeah.
Well, you guys are doing great, and I think the new album's great. And this was a—I hope you had a fun time in here today.
Oh yeah,
yeah, we did.
We'll be back.
All right, you can hang around for if
we
you want.
We know where you live now.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
And so, how many dates you doing?
What we got? I think it's 90 dates all
oh,
together.
Oh my God!
And it's over to a 10-week period.
Okay,
with breaks.
We're going through with breaks going through October.
And which website can people go look to see?
Tajmo.
Tajmo.com?
Yeah. Yep.
Thanks, fellas. I love talking to those guys, but there was no way I could facilitate playing. I'm just glad we got that few seconds there with Taj. I can play. You want me to play some dirty blues-oriented material? Okay. All right. Oh, by the way, my Netflix special has a date, September 5th. All right, if you're still listening, September 5th is the date of my Netflix special. And just a little commentary that I didn't do at the top about our current political situation. Of course he knew. Of course. Of course. Okay, That's my political commentary. And now I'll get my rig set up and put my headphones, my earplugs in so I don't blow my ears out. God damn it. Boomer lives!